Is that where we're at? Okay. All right. Let me find that in my notes. So Antiochus Epiphanes, he comes into power, grabbing hold of a throne that is not rightfully his. And as he gets this throne, as he comes into power over the, remember there's the two households, the Ptolemy, the household, which is the king of the south, or Egypt, and the Seleucid household, which is the king of the north, or Syria. So he is of the Seleucid household, and he has now taken that throne over. And as he comes into his power, he has crises that he needs to face. And the first one on your list there would be financial. That'd be the first crisis that he faces, is the financial crisis. Remember when his daddy, Antiochus the Great, was confronted by Rome, and Rome put a stop to his empire building. They placed a very heavy stipend, very heavy penalty on Antiochus the Great. And so when Antiochus the Fourth came in, there's too many Antiochuses, but when Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes came into power, he discovered that the kingdom's treasuries were bankrupt, were broke. And so due to this financial crisis, he does what any good pagan king does, and he begins to rob the temples. So he goes around to all the various pagan temples, and he begins to strip the temples of their gold and their silver, their precious stones, including the temple there in Jerusalem as well. So the first thing that he faces is a financial crisis. The second thing he faces is lack of solidarity. That's your next blank. Lack of solidarity. There was disunity in the Syrian kingdom of the north at this time. Remember, there was some power play going on with the death of Seleucus the Fourth by Heliodorus. His tax collector had believed Heliodorus poisoned Seleucus the Fourth to take over the throne. And so there was some problems there. And so to meet this challenge, not only that, the kingdom itself was kind of fractured. And so to meet this challenge, what Antiochus put into practice was a very strict, rigorous policy to Hellenize his subjects. In other words, make them thoroughly Greek. Language, culture, philosophy. So he began to force upon his subjects the Greek culture. He employed Greek teachers. He employed philosophers. He built gymnasiums right next door to all of the different temples, including the temple in Jerusalem. He built these gymnasium and public markets. Now, when we think of a gymnasium, right, what do we think of? We think of a place to go and exercise, right, to lift weights. And you can tell I do a lot of that. But the gymnasium in that time as well was also a cultural center that the Greek way of life, the Greek perspective, that the Greek philosophy would be taught in the gymnasium. So kind of like with your yoga, there's a certain philosophy behind that yoga. The same thing here with the Greek gyms. There was a philosophy that was being taught as these young men and women would go in there and they would exercise. And this was a very successful campaign all across his kingdom. This was a very successful campaign, except for in one place. And guess where that was? Yeah, those old stiff-necked Jews in Jerusalem. That was the one place that there was a little bit of a problem. The third thing that Antiochus faced was a foreign threat. He faced a foreign threat. There were three powers that Antiochus was dealing with at this time. Up-and-coming Rome. They were starting to come into power. And then Egypt, of course, the king of the south, they were a continuous thorn in his flesh. And then there was a third power. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. The power of Parthia or Persia. And this, of course, was located in what we know of today as Iran. All right, so this was a an up-and-coming power threat to Antiochus, because it was right there on the border of his kingdom there. And so Parthia, or Persia, was becoming a major political and cultural power, and that's located in modern-day Iran. So on your worksheet, the parallel with the future Antichrist and Antiochus IV can be appreciated here, because there's every indication that the future Antichrist, when he comes into power, he'll also come into a financial crisis. He'll also come into a financial crisis. The book of Revelation speaks of stern measures enacted by this man in buying and selling. You remember what it said in Revelation 13, what you have to do? Well, I shouldn't say you, but those people who are living at that time, what do they have to do in order to buy and sell? Yeah, they have to receive a mark either on their hand or their forehead, right? They have to receive a mark. Also, during this time, famine is predicted, because there's going to be disease, and there's going to be war, and there's going to be famine. So there's a famine predicted. And Revelation 6:6 says, "And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts saying, 'A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine.'" A penny in biblical days was a full day's wage. A full day's wage. So that's expensive. That is hyperinflation is what that is. And so the Antichrist very, very possibly is going to come into a hyperinflated economy. Isn't that kind of what currently today we're kind of, you know, worried about? And the experts are all talking about, you know, the market's going to crash and, you know, all this kind of, well, it's always there. It's always there. And I believe that is what the Antichrist, it's interesting. I'm an amateur historian, but one of my favorite times to study is during World War II, prior to Hitler taking power over in Germany. Germany suffered a hyperinflation, and I remember seeing pictures in history books where I saw where a man had a wheelbarrow full of money. And he was taking this money to go to the grocery store to buy some food for his family, but it took a wheelbarrow full of money. Now we're seeing that very same thing today in what country? Venezuela. Venezuela, right? The very same thing as I saw a couple of weeks back, I saw a scene of one of the streets in Venezuela. I can't remember the capital of the city, capital of Venezuela. But people were taking their money and throwing it in the street because it was worthless. It was just trash. Trash. So hyperinflation. So hyperinflation was also used by Hitler to take over Germany. That was one of the tools that he used to put his party into power, the National Socialistic German Workers' Party. He used this hyperinflation to worm his way into power. Something else about the Antichrist is unity in his kingdom will also be a challenge. That's also there on your worksheet. The future Antichrist will be faced with three major threats. And as we progress through Daniel chapter 11, and we'll get to that part, we're going to see that the Antichrist is not going to have that full dictatorial reign that a lot of folks like to claim that he's going to have. He's going to have his hands full. He's going to have three major threats that he's going to have to deal with, some major conflicts that he's going to have to deal with. So he's going to be a very powerful man, but he's not going to have, you know, absolute control like some of these popular preachers like to preach he's going to have. And we'll see that when we get there. Because of these threats, because of these challenges, I believe that's also where this peace treaty comes in, the seven-year peace treaty he's going to have. I think that has a part to do with that. And it's interesting to me, with Antiochus IV, he had a threat from Persia and Iran and that area. Who's kind of the troublemaker in the world today? It's the very same people. It's the very same region that's the troublemakers today. So I'm thinking that, this is just my speculation, I'm thinking when the Antichrist comes into power, I'm thinking he's still going to have the same people to deal with that Antiochus had to deal with as being troublemakers. Because I don't think everybody is going to be happy about that 7-year peace deal that he's made with Israel. And it could be that the Islamic nations may be some of those folks that aren't going to like it. Because we're going to read about an invasion. And we'll talk about that when we get there. Third, he'll also be faced with a triple threat to his authority and political power. His authority and political power. Daniel 7:7-24, we read where he has to subdue three kings, right? The 10 horns that came up on this beast. Three of those horns got plucked up by the roots, right? Three of those horns were plucked up. And these three horns represent three kings or three rulers. What happens during this time that the Antichrist has to pluck up these three horns, I don't know. But when you pull out a horn, that's pretty violent, isn't it? It's pretty messy. So I'm thinking that when that happens, that's going to be a very violent act that he's going to have to perform on these three rulers. And he's going to somehow justify it. And everybody's going to buy into it. Everybody's going to buy into it. Again, going back to our buddy Hitler, he did the very same thing. He was wiping out those who opposed him and was able to justify it with the people. You know, they were enemies of the state or they were going against, I don't know. That's just speculation. So what Antiochus Epiphanes faced in the beginning of his reign could very well be the same issues that the Antichrist will face when he starts showing up on the scene. Finances, unity in his kingdom, a challenge to his authority, to his political power. I think all of these things that the Antichrist is going to have to overcome, just like Antiochus Epiphanes had to overcome. Daniel 11:22, it says, "And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant." So history shows us that Antiochus soon began campaigning in order to strengthen his hold on this throne that he had no right to. All right, so he started campaigning, and he started strengthening his hold on this throne. And so this region had enjoyed some 25 years of relative peace under Antiochus the Great. And what he started to do, what Antiochus the Fourth started to do, he started to take out all of those folks who were opposing his right to the throne. And one of these folks was this guy right here who poisoned Antiochus's brother to get the throne. Well, he tried to take the throne back from Antiochus, and Antiochus defeated him. Okay, so that's just one of those things that Antiochus had to do to strengthen his hold. So when it says, you know, he'll be like a flood that's overflown, that's exactly what he was doing. He was doing a power play in order to strengthen his hold on the throne that he was not allowed, or it was not rightfully his. In fact, the throne rightfully belonged to Demetrius, who was the son of Seleucus IV. But at the time, Demetrius was a prisoner in Rome. Because if you remember, one of the things that Rome put upon Antiochus the Great was, not only do you pay us all this money, but you also give us some of your children, so that we'll hold them as hostages so that you'll behave yourself. And Demetrius was one of those hostages. And he was the rightful heir to the throne. So he starts going, and he starts gaining control over this kingdom, over Syria, and he turns his attention to the glorious land, or Jerusalem, right? And he says here, but with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Okay, so the prince of the covenant is this fellow right here, Onias. He's the high priest at the time. And so what Antiochus does, he has some folks in Jerusalem who were his allies. They were Jews, but they were his allies. They were sympathetic to his Hellenizing ways. In other words, they wanted to adopt the Greek culture and the Greek language and all of that. So they were sympathetic to what Antiochus was trying to do. And so what happened was they murdered the high priest, Onias. They got him out of the way. And what they did was, is they set up another high priest. Now, let me see here, make sure I cover all the bases. They call him the Prince of the Covenant because he was the head of the theocracy and he was the steward of the scriptures at the time. That's why they call him the Prince of the Covenant. He was the head of the theocracy and he was also the steward of the scriptures. And so that's why the Bible refers to him in that fashion. Notice, little p prince. Little p prince. So Antiochus' sympathizers murder this man, Onias. And a man by the name of Joshua becomes high priest. And this shows you where Joshua's heart is. He changes his name to Jason. Okay, so he changes from his Hebrew name and he adopts a Greek name. And so now he's known as Jason, and he's a man of a household, the household of Tobias. And the household of Tobias was an aristocratic, very wealthy, very influential family. And so that's who got the office of the high priest. Not because Jason was a son of Aaron, right? It was purely a political move. And it was at this period of time that the rot began to sit in as far as that whole system is concerned, just as Antiochus was hoping it would. So, just as Antiochus IV had done, he had replaced the true high priest with his own high priest. The future Antichrist is going to do the same thing, isn't he? And who's to say he may not replace the Jewish high priest at that time with his own false prophet? Right? Revelation 13:11. There's a lamb with horns that comes up. And he does all these miracles in the presence of the beast. Now, could it be that this false prophet will replace the priests of Jerusalem in that time? I don't know. It's possible. It says here in Daniel 11:23. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. So the second thing is Antiochus then begins infiltrating the land with a small contingent of deceivers and sympathizers to his rule. And he uses this small group or these small people. Another way to look at that is he uses a minority, a very powerful, very influential minority. That's what it means by small people. So he uses this minority, thank you, and this minority starts exerting its influence, trying to convince the rest of the Jews and saying, hey, this is the way to go. Forget that old-time religion. Let's adopt this Greek way of life. I mean, besides that, you know, that just seems to be the way to go. And so through this very small and influential and wealthy group of Jews, Antiochus Epiphanes begins to trick and deceive the majority of the Jewish leadership through propaganda, through out-and-out lies, through bribery, through backdoor politics, whatever it takes in order to win the Jews over to the Greek ways, so much so that some of the Jewish men was having surgery to reverse their circumcisions. So that's how influential they were becoming. That's how influential this small minority of people were becoming. And because of their efforts, priests were abandoning sacrifices. Jewish young men stopped going to synagogue and started going to gymnasiums, right? They would go to these gymnasiums and they'd be indoctrinated by the Greek ways. In fact, the high priest Jason even sent money to Tyre to purchase a sacrifice to be offered to Hercules. So you could see what was going on here. They were being assimilated by the Borg. A little Star Trek thing there. Probably the only one in here who has that, who understands that. You got, okay, thank you. At least two of us. So in Antiochus's short 10-year reign, the Jewish people were in severe danger of being assimilated into Greek culture. That was a big, big threat to the Jewish people. All through this small, influential, wealthy minority. Does that not sound kind of familiar? Because that's usually the way it happens, isn't it? You get a small, influential, outspoken, powerful activist minority, and it seems like it just affects everybody. And that's what was going on. Number three. Antiochus practiced all forms of bribery as he purchased the allegiance of important leaders and citizens in the region. He did this all throughout his kingdom. And he had pretty good success all throughout his kingdom. The only place that he kept experiencing resistance was right here in Jerusalem with the Jews. That was the one sticking place in his plan. The Jews became a thorn in his flesh. The Orthodox Jews who were standing firm, if you remember, this is where the Pharisees came from. The Pharisees came from this environment. These were the guys that they were going to stand fast on the law. They were going to stand fast on the Mosaic law. That's where the Pharisees came from this period of time. So the Orthodox Jews became obstinate. They became resistant. And no matter how much coercion, no much corruption, no much bribery, they were not going to budge. You know, I'm thinking, again, this is my speculation. I'm thinking that when the Antichrist shows up, there's going to be Jews who are going to be sympathetic to what the Antichrist is wanting to do. And they're going to support the Antichrist. And they're going to buy into his peace agreement. I think there are going to be some Jews who are very influential, powerful Jews, who will be very influential and will convince the nation that this is a good way to go. Just as there were powerful Jews who were bribed and duped in the days of Antiochus, so also there may be powerful Jews, intellectuals and politicians, who may be bribed and duped during the reign of the Antichrist. You know, politics always produces strange bedfellows, doesn't it? Well, it's no different back in Antiochus's day. It's no different today, and it won't be any different in the future when the Antichrist shows up, because who's the god of this world? It's the same God of this world, and it's the same system that works back in that day and in this day and in the day to come. And who knows, you know, what they'll sell out on for the sake of national safety and peace. I mean, Neville Chamberlain, he sold out for peace in our day. He bought into what Hitler was saying to him. It happens. So Daniel 11:24, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Antiochus gave portions of the promised land to those who were his sympathizers. He gave out portions of the promised land to those who were sympathizers in his intrigues and in his efforts to Judaize or to Hellenize the Jews. The land that God had promised to Abraham, right? This man was taking upon himself to dole it out as he saw fit. Are they not kind of squabbling over the land today? Sure they are. Sure they are. I found an interesting passage in Joel chapter 3 and verse 2. Joel chapter 3 and verse 2. I think the future Antichrist will do the very same thing. And I think the future Antichrist will be judged for doing this very same thing. In Joel chapter 3 and verse 2, it says, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. The word parted my land means to distribute and apportion shares or properties. This, again, is speculation on my part. But could it be that the Antichrist, in sealing the seven-year deal, may not also partition some of the promised land to those who support this plan of his? Using it as a bribe or as a reward or as an incentive? It's possible. It's possible. That's exactly what Antiochus did. Hey, guys, if you support me in this, then I will give you this. I will give you Nabob's vineyard. Verse 25, it says, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand. For they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. So Antiochus Epiphanes' sister Cleopatra, is that on your sheet? Yeah. Cleopatra and her husband Ptolemy have died. Okay? And now Ptolemy the VI is in power. And he's just a boy. He's just a boy. Ptolemy the VI is in power. Ptolemy died in 180 BC. Cleopatra died in 173 BC. And so Ptolemy the VI becomes king of Egypt, and he is the nephew of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is Antiochus's nephew. Because remember, Cleopatra was Antiochus's daughter when he was trying to gain control over Egypt. Now it says here about forecasting devices against him. Counselors, this is on your sheet, counselors of the young Egyptian king began to convince the king, hey, you know what? Jerusalem and that land belongs to you. That's the counsel they start giving this young boy. That Jerusalem and that land up there, that all rightfully belongs to Egypt, and you should go up there and take it back. You should go up there and take it back and claim what's rightfully yours. So Ptolemy VI, this boy, easily influenced by the advice of his counselors, he gathers up an army and he starts marching out to claim what he believes is rightfully his. All right? Well, Antiochus Epiphanes gets winds of this, and so he marches out to meet him. And before the Egyptian forces could cross the desert to get to where Jerusalem is, Antiochus meets him with his army and defeats him and captures his nephew. Who's just maybe 11 or 12 years of age. He's just a kid. And so this young Egyptian king, just like it says right here in the passage, he was deceived by his counselors, and they brought about his defeat. They deceived him into believing he could reclaim lost territory. And also when he fled to Alexandria, where his fortress was, they also gave him bad counsel of get out of the city. He shouldn't have done that. He should have stayed put. Because when he got out of the city and tried to run, that's when he got captured by his uncle. That's what it means in here in verse 25, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. That's that bad counsel they were given this young king. That's what he means by forecast devices. That's the bad counsel that he received. Verse 26, it says, yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. So they that were nourished by the boy's king's table were those who were instrumental in his defeat. So his counselors were the reason why he was defeated. The very men that sat around his table and told him, this is what you should do, is the ones who brought about his defeat. That's what that means there in verse 26. So Antiochus Epiphanes wasn't finished with his young nephew yet. Jerome, in his commentary, he writes, the king of the south, that is the generals of Ptolemy, could not stand against the fraudulent schemes of Antiochus, for he pretended to be at peace with his sister's son and ate bread with him, and afterward took possession of Egypt. And that's exactly what the next verse says. In verse 27 of Daniel 11, it says, and both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. All right, remember, now Daniel lived back in 600 and some B.C. So 400 years before that happened, the angel told Daniel, this is the way it's going to go down. And guess what? That's exactly how it went down. And both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper. Antiochus and his nephew Ptolemy sat together at a table to work out a peace agreement. And both men were lying through their teeth with the intention of breaking their part of the peace talks when it best suited their own plans. You can read about that in history books. So just as Daniel 11:27 said it would happen, that's exactly the way it happened. As they were sitting around this table talking about peace agreements, they were lying to one another. Both men were speaking peace while mischief and treachery was in their hearts. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes claimed that he had his nephew's best interest at heart. And young Ptolemy, he was saying, I know you do, uncle, I know you do, and I believe you do. But he was only saying that to buy time. Well, Antiochus was lying to his nephew because all along Antiochus' intention was to take over Egypt. So they both sat at this table and they were lying through their teeth to one another, pretending to have mutual trust in each other. That doesn't happen today, does it? Again, we see another prophetic picture of the future Antichrist that's on your sheet, who will quite likely practice deception. He brokers a 7-year peace agreement with Israel. That's why I show that illustration of the guy there with the two faces and his fingers crossed behind his back. That's your Antichrist. He'll broken a 7-year peace agreement, but what happens after 3.5 years? He breaks it. He breaks it. 1 Thessalonians 5:3 says, "For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." That phrase there, as travail upon a woman with child, if you're a Bible student, what does that always refer to? The tribulation period. The tribulation period. So the Antichrist is going to be speaking peace to the Jews, right? And then all of a sudden, here comes the travail. Daniel 8:25 says, "And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand." Craft or deceit or treachery or chicanery. There's an old-fashioned word. So on your worksheet, just as Antiochus Epiphanes assured his young nephew that he had his nephew's best interests at heart, down there, Daniel 8:25, and falsely assured him of peace and safety, perhaps the Antichrist will do the very same thing with Israel. He will lie to them as he sits at the same table hashing out these peace terms. Because his father is a liar, right? Daniel 11:28 says, "And then he shall return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land." And Dell's not here, because Dell has been bothering me about this word exploits for the last 6 weeks, and he's not even here. He says, "Are you going to get to it? Are you going to get to it?" I said, "No, not yet, not yet." Okay, well, you can tell him I covered it. Exploits. This word exploits is only found right here in the book of Daniel. It's the only time you're going to find it in your Bible. The only time. And notice that it's written in italics, right? So it's found in Daniel 11:28. It's found in Daniel 11:32. The King James translators were honest enough to show their insertions into the text to help you understand the translation of that Greek, Hebrew phrase or that Aramaic phrase. So the word exploit has two definitions. And I looked up an old Webster's. The first definition is a noble or courageous act. A noble or courageous act. And that certainly describes the actions of those folks that we're going to look at here pretty soon in Daniel 11:32. Daniel 11:32, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." These were the Maccabees. These were the Maccabees who fought the war of independence to free themselves from Antiochus's reign. The second definition of the word exploit is to use unfairly for one's personal advantage. And that's exactly what Antiochus IV was guilty of doing as far as the people of Israel were concerned or anybody was concerned, because he was all about power. It was all about power. On his way back to Syria, I want to make sure I'm still on my sheet here. Yeah, page, it wouldn't make any difference to you guys. You don't have a page 23. On his way back to Syria, Antiochus IV stopped in Jerusalem and robbed the temple of its treasures, stripping it of all of its gold and its silver, and even taking the furniture with him. That's what it means there, where he said he returned into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits. Those exploits were he robbed the temple. He robbed the temple. When Antiochus went to meet the Egyptian threat, prodded on by his nephew's counselors, he had passed through Jerusalem the first time as he went down to meet the army of the king of the south. And because of the efforts of the minority in Hellenizing the Jews, when Antiochus marched through Jerusalem that first time going down to meet the threat, the Jews lined the cities with torches and praised Antiochus as he marched through the city when he went down the first time. But when he came back up from defeating his nephew and marched back through Jerusalem, it was a different story. Flushed with his success in Egypt, he demanded entrance into the temple. He demanded entrance into the temple. He wanted to go into the temple. He wanted to go into a place that you guys know as well as I do, Gentiles are not allowed to go. But you see, in Antiochus's mind, this was his kingdom. And Jerusalem was just another city in his kingdom. He was king. Who had better right to go wherever he wanted to go in his kingdom than the king? And as far as the temple in Jerusalem was concerned, in his mind, it was just another temple. No different from any other temple that he'd ever come across, whether it's a temple to Zeus or a temple to Hercules or a temple to Pan. It didn't make any difference to him. It was just another temple. And so there were some steadfast, loyal Jews to Jehovah and to the temple, and they barred entrance to Antiochus. They would not allow him to go into the temple. In spite of what Jason was trying to convince them to do, in spite of all of the Hellenizing that was going on, there were some Jews who were still faithful to Jehovah, still faithful to the temple. And so they tried to prevent him from going into the temple. Well, it didn't work. It didn't work. Because Antiochus sent his troops in. And he dispatched those people who prevented him from going into the temple. And then he had his troops strip the temple of its gold, its silver, took all the furniture, the table of showbread, the candlestick, the incense altar. And he even entered into the Holy of Holies, which you know is, you just don't do that. He even entered into the Holy of Holies. And guess what he found? Nothing. The Ark of the Covenant wasn't in there. I thought that was kind of interesting. So I did some research. And what I found is this. In the 2 Maccabees chapter 2, it shows that the prophet Jeremiah, prompted by a divine message from God, gave orders to the faithful Jews in Jerusalem at that time that the tent of meeting and the ark should go with him. Then he went away to the mountain from the top of which Moses saw God's promised land. And when he reached the mountain, Jeremiah found a cave dwelling. He carried the tent and the ark and he put it in the entrance and he blocked up the entrance. So according to Jewish tradition, Jeremiah took the Holy of Holies and hid it in a cave somewhere. And then, again, according to Jewish tradition, okay, guys, this is not gospel, but according to Jewish tradition, the place shall remain unknown until God finally gathers his people together and shows mercy to them, and the Messiah comes. And when the Messiah comes, then he will reveal its hiding place. according to Jewish tradition. According to Jewish tradition. So anyway, Antiochus comes in and he strips the place of the gold. And he even takes the veil. And he takes the veil down. And he dedicates the veil to a temple of Zeus in Olympia. And and this is remarkable too. In the second century AD, there's record of folks going to this temple and seeing a fabulous veil of cunning work hanging in the temple. So that temple, that veil stood there for a long time. Of course, they made a new veil to replace the one that was stolen. And what happened to that veil? Got ripped in half, didn't it? Something else about that veil. I'm sorry, it's a little rabbit trail. It's interesting about that veil that got ripped in half from the top to the bottom. They tried to mend that veil. They did. They tried to mend it. But it would never stay mended. It would always split apart. No matter what they did, it always split apart. Kind of says something, doesn't it? Okay, Daniel 11:29 says here, and at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter, for the ships of Kittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant, so shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. That's the thing that Jesus talked about. So here we see the beginning of the end of Antiochus Epiphanes IV. Antiochus's nephew, Ptolemy VI, ruled the upper portion of Egypt, and his brother, Ptolemy Euergetes, ruled the bottom southern half of Egypt. And so they both got their heads together and said, hey, let's join forces. Let's join forces against this Antiochus Epiphanes. And so they did. They joined forces. And I think this is in your sheet. Ptolemy VI and Ptolemy Euergetes joined forces in united front against Antiochus IV, and so break the sham of a peace treaty they had both deceptively agreed to. Is that on your sheet? Yep, there it is, right there on the top. With the defection of his nephew, Ptolemy, Antiochus again comes back to Egypt. He's not going to sit still for this. And so he marches down to Egypt. And so he comes up to the chief port city of Alexandria, where both of these brothers are holed up. And then Antiochus comes face to face with the next empire to rise on the scene. The ships of Kittim refer to Rome. The ships of Kittim refer to Rome. Rome at this time is beginning to flex its military muscle. It's starting to become an empire. It's starting to become a very powerful and influential empire. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that the Hebrews call all islands and regions beyond Cyprus and beyond the sea Kittim. And something else, another source that I read, a couple of rabbis, a rabbi Rashi and a rabbi Nachmanides, I know I butchered those names, they're quoted in teaching that this was a fulfillment of Balaam's prophecy in Numbers 24:24. Numbers 24:24, Balaam says, and ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Eber, and he also shall perish forever. And so they taught that the Romans were predicted by Balaam to arise and afflict Asher, which is Syria, which is the king of the north, right? And Eber, who's Eber? Hebrews. And it says here, and that he also shall perish forever. And they believe that this is in reference of a mighty enemy of Israel perishing. Now that mighty enemy of Israel could very well be this Antiochus Epiphanes or the Antichrist in the future. So what happened is that Egypt appealed to Rome for assistance against the Syrian forces of Antiochus Epiphanes when he came down to Alexandria. Rome, who had been occupied with conquering Macedonia and all that area up in there, their hands were now free. So when these two kings, Ptolemy the sixth and Ptolemy Euergetes, when they appealed to Rome, Rome, of course, was free to help. And she was more than happy to help because that gave them a foothold, right, in Egypt. So as Antiochus's army marched towards Alexandria, a Roman emissary by the name of Gaius Linnaeus handed Antiochus a letter from the Roman city or Senate forbidding him from entering Alexandria. This far, no further. And the Roman emissary, while Antiochus was standing there, this Roman emissary ordered one of his soldiers to draw a circle around Antiochus. And then he told Antiochus, you make your decision before you step out of that circle. That's kind of like drawing a line in the sand, right? So he told Antiochus Epiphanes, you make a decision before you step out of that circle. You either retreat and go back home, or you take us on. Well, he didn't want to take on Rome. He didn't want to face a war with powerful Rome. Remember, he was a prisoner in Rome. And he saw Rome firsthand, and he saw what was going on there, and he saw the power. So he knew that he was not wanting to have a war with Rome. So what does he do? He retreats. He retreats. Now think a minute here. Antiochus IV he's a madman. I mean, he calls himself a god, but he's also a madman. That was his nickname, Epiphanes. He had an ego to beat the band. He had an ego to beat the band. So when this Roman emissary came to him and drew this circle around him and he had to make the decision to retreat, that was deeply humiliating to this guy. Deeply humiliating to this guy. In fact, historians say that it was that incident with the circle in the sand that Antiochus became unhinged. He just became unhinged. So the madman became a psychopath. He just lost it. He just completely lost it, according to historians. So it says here, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. He is grieved. The word grieved means to be cowed. Right? To be cowed. To be browbeaten. This is a very proudful man. He just had his ego stepped on. He just had his ego stepped on. And he was greatly humiliated. And so instead of resorting to Twitter, he takes his humiliation out on the Jewish people. He takes his humiliation and shame out on the Jewish people. And so he marches back to Jerusalem. And he begins a campaign of slaughter and sacrilege. Because a rumor was going on in Jerusalem at the time that Antiochus came up face to face with Rome. Rome defeated him and killed him. So as far as the Jews in Jerusalem were concerned, especially the faithful Jews, they were thinking, all right, Antiochus is dead. And so they begin to celebrate. That's the rumor. This is what Antiochus heard, the rumor. So he's thinking that these people in Jerusalem, thinking he was dead, were celebrating. over his death. Well, this caused him to be a little bit peeved. And so he hears about this celebration and this revolt because the faithful Jews began to kick out the Hellenizers, right? They started to boot them out of the city. And so Antiochus hears about this celebrating. He hears about this revolt. He hears about the city just being turned upside down. And so like a kicked dog, he goes to Jerusalem and he inflicts his wrath and humiliation upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Verse 31, in arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. So on your worksheet, Antiochus the Fourth desecrates the temple and the altar. And it's interesting that this period of time begins 3.5 years of persecution inflicted upon the Jewish people by Antiochus and his generals. So this begins 3.5 years of severe persecution upon the Jewish people by Antiochus. He erects this altar to Zeus over the altar of Jehovah, abomination of desolation. He has his troops gather all the faithful Jews of the city, those who claim allegiance to Jehovah and the Mosaic law, and he forces them to eat swine flesh. Those who eat swine flesh, he spares. Those who refuse to eat the swine flesh, off with their heads. He kills them. At this time, Antiochus slays some 40,000 Jews, and then he sells some 40,000 into slavery. Verse 32 of Daniel, it says, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity, by spoil, many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. So, persecution and oppression is brought upon the Jewish people by Antiochus, and he continues to corrupt those who are faithful to Jehovah through forceful means. He's forcing them to bow to him. It costs their lives to be faithful to Jehovah. Some of the people revolt and fight against Antiochus. And there's revivals among the people, but a lot of people lose their lives in the process. That's what it means by they shall fall by the sword and by the flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. They're not sitting still for this, but Antiochus is a very powerful individual. He's got a very powerful army. And you're talking about everyday Joes, right? That probably don't have a lever-action Winchester in their house or something like that, right? But they're standing up. In verse 32 it says, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. This marks out the period of the Maccabean Revolt. And it is the Maccabean Revolt that eventually will defeat Antiochus's grip on Jerusalem. It says here, now when they shall fall, they shall be hoping with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. This describes pretty accurately the history of this time. The Maccabean Revolt started with a man by this man, Mattathias, be my guess. He had 5 sons, and he refused to make an offering to the pagan gods of Antiochus. A Greek officer came to his village and demanded that Mattathias, being a priest, sacrificed to one of the pagan gods of the Greeks. He refused. He refused to do it. And one of the Jews who wanted to keep peace, who didn't want to see the village wiped out because that's exactly what was going on, he stands up and he says, I'll go ahead and I'll sacrifice to the pagan god just to keep peace and to spare the village. Well, Mattathias' zeal was such that he stepped forward and not only killed the Jew that was willing to compromise, but he killed the Greek general or the Greek officer that came and demanded a sacrifice be made. And Mattathias, filled with the zeal for God, pulled down this pagan altar, and then he cries out, "Follow me, every one of you who is zealous for the law and strives to maintain the covenant, follow me." And so a group of men in the village follow Mattathias as he goes off into the hills. And at first it was a guerrilla warfare, that's in your sheet, that shall be hoping with a little help, but grew in momentum into finally a full-scale revolution. The phrase, "but many shall cleave to them with flatteries," that's talking about the Jews who are still loyal to Antiochus. Are still loyal to Antiochus, even though the Maccabees started this revolt. So by the time the Maccabees, under the leadership of Judas Maccabee, came into full force, they eventually succeeded in driving Antiochus' forces out of Jerusalem. They finally succeeded in doing that. It took years. And when they entered into the temple complex, it looked like a wasteland. It looked like a wasteland. The high priest at the time was a man by the name of Menelaus. He was a sympathizer. He was an ally of Antiochus IV, a notorious Hellenizer. He abandoned all worship in the temple. And the temple area essentially was a garbage dump. Okay? It was a garbage dump. Any kind of garbage you'd find in the temple area. That's where it came to. So this was a time of severe testing and purging between the faithful Jehovah and those who followed this wicked man, Antiochus. Verse 35, "And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed." So the faithful Jews, that's on your sheet, the faithful Jews of Antiochus' day was severely tried and many perished, but they survived. The Jewish faith had faced its severest threat under the persecution of this wicked king up to this point in their history. God will always have his faithful remnant. He will always have his faithful remnant. Isaiah 45:17 says, "But Israel shall be saved in the Lord with an everlasting salvation. You shall not be ashamed nor confounded, world without end." There's one consistency in this world, and it is the Jewish people. There will always be the Jewish people because that's the way God promised it. The Jews of Antiochus' day survived the threat of annihilation, as did the Jews in the days of Esther when Haman sought their destruction. To this day, the Jews celebrate two holidays beside the feast. They celebrate two holidays, and both holidays are in remembrance for God's deliverance. The first one is Purim, and the second one is Hanukkah. So Purim and Hanukkah are the two feasts that they celebrate for God's deliverance. A rabbi by the name of Isaac Meyer commented on these two feasts. He says, "On Purim, we celebrate the annulment of the royal edict to destroy the body. But on Hanukkah, we were rescued from the decree which would have destroyed our souls." Because of the Hellenizing attempt of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Jews were in grave danger as a people, as a culture, of disappearing. That was a big threat. That was a big threat. The Bible teaches that before the establishment of the Messianic kingdom, there will be a time of unprecedented persecution for the Jews, isn't there? That's what the Bible says. And on your sheet, the final spiritual state of the Jewish peoples will come about only after experiencing a time of great purging and cleansing. Jeremiah 2:22 says, For though thou wash thee with nitre, and take thee much soap, yet thine iniquity is marked before me, saith the Lord. And then Malachi 3, But who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. And then finally, on your worksheet, just as the Jews overcame the physical threats of Antiochus IV and the spiritual menace of Hellenism, so will the Jews in the reign of the Antichrist survive emerging as a purged and refined people ready to receive the Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. Zechariah 3:13-18 says, "It shall come to pass in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die." Two-thirds of Israel will perish during that time. "But the third shall be left therein, and I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God." So the Jews are going to pass through this period of time, and that is Antiochus Epiphanes. And like I said, he is the Old Testament type to the New Testament Antichrist. There is a lot of similarities between this man and the Antichrist yet to come. So when we get back together again, we're going to see in Daniel a leap in time. A leap in time. And what we're going to study next in the remaining portions of Daniel chapter 11 is we're going to be looking at the Antichrist and that period of time when he is on the earth that we know of as the 70th week of Daniel. Okay? So, did everybody get all their slots filled? The last two? Very last two, such as the final spiritual state of the Jewish peoples, will come about only after experiencing time of great purging and cleansing. And then the last paragraph or the last statement, just as the Jews overcame the physical threats of Antiochus IV and the spiritual menace of Hellenism, so will the Jews in the reign of Antichrist survive emerging as a purged and refined people. Okay? Yes? Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, for your patience. Let's go ahead and have a word of prayer, and then, oh, I'm sorry, Brian. Praise the Lord for the Bible conference in Celsius Springs. Really? Cool.